How the Word is Passed, a reckoning with the history of slavery across America. Written and read by Clint Smith. Our past was slavery. We cannot recur to it with any sense of complacency or composure. The history of it is a record of stripes, a revelation of agony. It is written in characters of blood. Its breath is a sigh, its voice a groan, and we turn from it with a shudder. The duty of today is to meet the questions that confront us with intelligence and courage. Frederick Douglass, The Nation's Problem. You know, they straightened out the Mississippi River in places to make room for houses and livable acreage. Occasionally, the river floods these places. Floods is the word they use. But in fact, it is not flooding. It is remembering. Remembering where it used to be. Toni Morrison, The Site of Memory. Author's note. The visits I describe in this book took place between October 2017 and February 2020. I visited some places on multiple occasions, others only once. All quotations were captured with a digital recorder. Some names have been changed to protect the privacy of individuals. I would like to note that while this book is focused on the places where the story of slavery in America lives on, the land upon which many of these historical sites sit belonged to indigenous communities before it belonged to anyone else. Of the 8 U.S.-based sites I visited for this book, New Orleans sits on Chitimacha and Choctaw land, Monticello sits on Monacan land, the Whitney Plantation sits on Choctaw land, Angola Prison sits on Choctaw land, the Blandford Cemetery sits on Appomattox and Nottoway land, Galveston, Texas sits on Akokisa, Karankawa, Atakapa land, New York City sits on Munsee Lenape land, the National Museum of African American History and Culture sits on Nacatank or Anacostan and Piscataway land. It should be noted that Native territories often overlapped and had malleable borders that shifted over time. This list is not definitive, but is one attempt to acknowledge those who first traversed this land and to do so as accurately as possible. Prologue. The whole city is a memorial to slavery. The sky above the Mississippi River stretched out like a song. The river was still in the windless afternoon, its water a yellowish brown from the sediment it carried across thousands of miles of farmland, cities, and suburbs on its way south. At dusk, the lights of the Crescent City Connection, a pair of steel cantilever bridges that cross the river and connect the east and west banks of New Orleans, flickered on. Luminous bulbs ornamented the bridge's steel beams like a congregation of fireflies settling onto the backs of two massive, unbothered creatures. A tugboat made its way downriver, pulling an enormous ship in its wake. The sounds of the French Quarter, just behind me, pulsed through the brick sidewalk underfoot. A pop-up brass band blared into the early evening air, its trumpets, tubas, and trombones commingling with the delight of a gathering crowd. A young man drummed on a pair of upturned plastic buckets, the drumsticks in his hands moving with speed and dexterity. People gathered for photos along the river's edge, hoping to capture an image of themselves surrounded by a recognizable piece of quintessential New Orleans iconography. After the transatlantic slave trade was outlawed in 1808, about 1 million people were transported from the Upper South to the Lower South. More than 100,000 of them were brought down the Mississippi River and sold in New Orleans. Leon A. Waters came and stood next to me on the riverfront, hands in pockets, lips compressed, overlooking the Mississippi's slow bend between the two shores of the city. I had been introduced to Waters by a group of young black activists in New Orleans who were part of the organization Take 'Em Down NOLA, whose self-espoused mission is the removal of all symbols of white supremacy in New Orleans as part of a broader push for racial and economic justice. Waters has served as a mentor to many members of the group. They see him as an elder statesman of their movement and credit him for being a central part of their political education. Waters, in his late 60s, with a graying mustache sitting over his lips, wore a black sports coat with a gray and white striped shirt with the top button undone. A navy blue tie hung loosely below his unfastened collar and swung over the waistband of his faded blue jeans. A pair of thin-frame, rectangular-shaped glasses sat high on the bridge of his nose, the left lens with a slight smudge in its bottom corner. His voice was low and unvarying in its tone. Waters might be mistaken for surly, but his disposition is simply a reflection of the seriousness with which he takes the subject matter he is often discussing, the subject of slavery. We were standing in front of a plaque recently put up by the New Orleans Committee to erect markers on the slave trade, outlining Louisiana's relationship to the transatlantic slave trade. "It's doing its job," Waters said of the plaque. "All through the day, people come in, they stop, they read, take pictures. It's another way of educating people to this." In recent years, markers like this began to go up throughout the city, each documenting a specific area's relationship to enslavement, part of a broader reckoning. After years of black people being killed by police and having their deaths broadcast in videos streamed across the world, after a white supremacist went into a black church in Charleston, South Carolina, and killed 9 people as they prayed, after neo-Nazis marched in Charlottesville, Virginia, to protect a Confederate statue and reclaim a history born of a lie, after George Floyd was killed by a police officer's knee on his neck, cities across the country have begun to more fully reckon with the history that made such moments possible. A history that many had previously been unwilling to acknowledge. Waters, who identifies as a local historian and revolutionary, was not new to this. He and others like him have for years been working to illuminate the city's legacy, and by extension the country's legacy, of oppression. Only recently, after decades of pushing by activists amid the larger groundswell of national pressure, have city officials begun to listen, or perhaps feel like they finally have the political capital to act. In 2017, New Orleans removed 4 statues and monuments that, it had determined, paid tribute to the legacy of white supremacy. The city removed memorials to Robert E. Lee, the general who led the Confederacy's most successful army during the Civil War, a slaveholder. Jefferson Davis, the first and only president of the Confederacy, a slaveholder. P.G.T. Beauregard, a general in the Confederate Army who ordered the first shots of the Civil War, a slaveholder. And a monument dedicated to the Battle of Liberty Place, an 1874 insurrection in which white supremacists attempted to overthrow the integrated Reconstruction-era state government of Louisiana. These monuments are gone now, but at least 100 streets, statues, parks, and schools named after Confederate figures, slaveholders, and defenders of slavery remain. On a cool February afternoon, Waters, the founder of Hidden History Tours of New Orleans, promised to show me where some of these vestiges of the past remain. Waters drove me past 2 schools named after John McDonough, a wealthy slave-owning merchant after whom dozens of schools, filled largely with black children, were named until the 1990s. We drove past shops and restaurants and hotels where there had once been offices, showrooms, and slave pens of more than a dozen slave trading firms that made New Orleans the largest slave market in antebellum America. Like the Omni Royal Orleans Hotel, built on the site of the St. Louis Hotel, where men, women, and children were bought, sold, and separated from one another. We drove past Jackson Square, in the heart of the tourist-filled French Quarter, where rebellious enslaved people were executed. Even the street on which Waters dropped me off at the end of our tour, where my parents live now, is named after Bernard de Marigny, a man who owned more than 150 enslaved people over the course of his lifetime. The echo of enslavement is everywhere. It is in the levees, originally built by enslaved labor. It is in the detailed architecture of some of the city's oldest buildings, sculpted by enslaved hands. It is in the roads, first paved by enslaved people. As historian Walter Johnson has said about New Orleans, the whole city is a memorial to slavery. New Orleans is my home. It is where I was born and raised. It is a part of me in ways I continue to discover. But I came to realize that I knew relatively little about my hometown's relationship to the centuries of bondage rooted in the city's soft earth, in the statues I had walked past daily, the names of streets I had lived on, the schools I had attended, and the buildings that had once been nothing more to me than the remnants of colonial architecture. It was all right in front of me, even when I didn't know to look for it. It was in May 2017, after the statue of Robert E. Lee near downtown New Orleans had been taken down from its 60-foot pedestal, that I became obsessed with how slavery is remembered and reckoned with teaching myself all the things I wish someone had taught me long ago. Our country is in a moment, at an inflection point, in which there is a willingness to more fully grapple with the legacy of slavery and how it shaped the world we live in today. But it seems that the more purposefully some places attempt to tell the truth about their proximity to slavery and its aftermath, the more staunchly other places have refused. I wanted to visit some of these places, those telling the truth, those running from it, and those doing something in between, in order to understand this reckoning. In How the Word is Passed, I traveled to 8 places in the United States, as well as one abroad, to understand how each reckons with its relationship to the history of American slavery. I visit a mix of plantations, prisons, cemeteries, museums, memorials, houses, historical landmarks, and cities. The majority of these sites are in the South, as this is where slavery was most saturated over the course of its nearly 250-year existence on these shores. But I also travel to New York City and Dakar, Senegal. Each chapter is a portrait of a place, but also of the people in that place, those who live there, work there, and are the descendants of the land and of the families who once lived on it. There are people who have tasked themselves with telling the story of that place outside traditional classrooms and beyond the pages of textbooks. They are, formally or informally, public historians who carry with them a piece of this country's collective memory. They have dedicated their lives to sharing this history with others. And for this book, many of them have generously shared that history with me. Monticello Plantation. There's a difference between history and nostalgia. Heading out from my home in Washington, D.C. in the morning, I drove against traffic, moving from the new condos of an increasingly gentrifying D.C. through the single-family home suburban landscape of Northern Virginia and into the vast green expanse surrounding I-95 South. As I drove to Monticello, I observed how Virginia is largely a tale of two states. Northern Virginia, those incorporated municipalities that serve as suburbs to the District of Columbia, has always felt somewhat distant from the South in the ways I grew up understanding it. But beyond the suburbs, once I started driving past the diners and gas stations with Dixie flags hanging in their windows, I was reminded that this state was once the bastion of the Confederacy. As I made my way down the highway, finding myself on cruise control both in the car and in my mind, I saw a sign in my peripheral vision indicating the entrance to a plantation. Assuming it to be Monticello, I put my blinker on and began to turn, only to jerk the car back onto the highway when I realized that this was not Thomas Jefferson's plantation, but that of James Madison, Jefferson's dear friend, confidant, fellow Virginian, and successor to his presidency. Madison's Montpelier Plantation, less than 30 miles northeast of Jefferson's, is almost a prelude to Monticello. Not simply as a result of their relative proximity, but because the two men share similarly contradictory relationships to the aspirational documents they ushered into existence while enslaved people worked on their plantations. The Madison family held more than 300 enslaved people over the course of their time on that property. Both of the men inscribed words that promoted equality and freedom in the founding documents of the United States while owning other human beings. Both men built a nation while making possible the plunder of millions of people. What they gave to our country and all they stole from it must be understood together. I did not turn into Montpelier, but there was something about driving past it on the way to Monticello that reminded me that Jefferson was not singular in his moral inconsistencies. Rather, he was one of the founding fathers who fought for their own freedom while keeping their boots on the necks of hundreds of others. Within a few miles of Monticello, the highway transitions into a one-way road lined with white pines and hemlocks. I pulled into the dirt parking lot and made my way up the concrete stairs to see if tour tickets were still available. One of the first things I noticed about Monticello is how the vast majority of its visitors seem to be white. It's not so much unexpected as it is markedly conspicuous to see a plantation that has had its ratios reversed. There were a few tourist groups from different Asian countries, but they were the small exception. 200 years ago, Monticello, like most plantations, was populated largely by the enslaved descendants of Africans, while white laborers and Jefferson's family were a much smaller proportion of its inhabitants. At any given time at Monticello, there were approximately 130 enslaved people, far outnumbering Jefferson, his family, and the paid white workers. I walked toward the stately mansion, which sat just a couple hundred feet ahead of me. Waves of heat rose from the dirt path, and mulberry trees spread themselves out across the land, creating intermittent pockets of cool respite for visitors. Underneath a lush sugar maple on one side of the house was a group of about a dozen people all sharing what city they had come from. The group ranged in age and geography, spanning generations and state borders. "And what about you, sir?" the guide said as I scurried under the tree where the rest of the group was standing. I had chosen the tour that began 10 minutes after I arrived, one that focused specifically on Jefferson's relationship to slavery. "From D.C., I said. "Right down the road," he responded, nodding his head and giving a smile that was as courteous as it was practiced. Before I was able to gather myself and bring my full attention to the group, I was struck by what lay behind us, in the distance. The entire plantation sat at the top of a mountain ringed by a thick cascade of sundry trees, so tightly packed together that I could not tell where one began and the next ended. Behind the first string of trees were rolling hills that went off in every direction, as the silhouette of outlying mountains kissed the clouds resting over their peaks. David Thorson, our guide, wore a blue and white striped Oxford shirt, short sleeve but a size too big, leaving his sleeves fluttering along his elbows when a light mountain breeze passed by. His crisply ironed khaki pants sat high on his waist, impressive creases moving down the front of his pant leg from his belt buckle to his shoes. David's peach face, reddened from all the hours spent standing in the sun, was clean-shaven and sunk gently into itself around his cheeks. Ridges and wrinkles made their way down his jawbone and onto his neck. He wore large, thick-rimmed glasses and a brown, wide-brimmed hat that cast a slight shadow over his eyes. He spoke with a calm, even-handedness that invited people into discussion, like a professor. I found out later that prior to becoming a tour guide at Monticello, David served for more than 30 years in the U.S. Navy. He had no experience as a teacher and no exposure to anything resembling museum studies before taking his job as a guide. Both of his children had enrolled in the University of Virginia, and he and his wife had fallen in love with Charlottesville during their frequent visits over the years. They loved it so much that they decided to relocate after David retired from the military, even though his children had graduated from the university long before. "I didn't want to sit around talking back to the TV set," he would tell me. "It gets you out where you're interacting with the public, with a broad international audience of people who have an interest in American history, an interest in Thomas Jefferson. So I was interested in sharing the story because I really do believe that you can't understand the United States without going back and understanding Jefferson." While the shadow over David's eyes gave him a sense of mystery, when he began speaking to the tour group, there was nothing enigmatic about what he was saying. "Slavery's an institution. In Jefferson's lifetime, it becomes a system. So what is this slave system? It is a system of exploitation, a system of inequality and exclusion, a system where people are owned as property and held down by physical and psychological force, a system being justified even by people who know slavery is morally wrong. By doing what? Denying the very humanity of those who are enslaved solely on the basis of the color of their skin." People in the group began to murmur to one another, some with their hands over their mouths. In just a few sentences, David had captured the essence of chattel slavery in a way that few of my own teachers ever had. It's not that this information was new, it's that I had not expected to hear it in this place, in this way, with this group of almost exclusively white visitors staring back at him. David paused and then said, "There's a struggle going on here." He continued discussing how Jefferson's relationship to slavery was in plain sight because Jefferson maintained extensive records, the best known of which is his farm book. In these documents, he kept track of the names, birth dates, locations, and sales of each person he held in bondage. He also kept track of the rations distributed to the enslaved. A typical week's worth of rations, said David, included a pack of cornmeal, half a pound of meat, usually pork, occasionally half a dozen salted fish. David discussed how Jefferson's records showed who was bought and sold over the course of decades. Jefferson sold, leased, and mortgaged enslaved people, often in an effort to pay off debts he owed, as well as to preserve his standard of living. The people Jefferson sold while he was alive were mostly from Poplar Forest, his plantation in Bedford County, but also from Monticello and a smaller plantation in Goochland County called Elk Hill. Having enslaved workers, David explained, helped Jefferson maintain his lifestyle by giving him the time and space to do what he cared about most, reading, writing, and hosting guests who came to visit. Jefferson also gave presents to his kids and grandkids, he said in a pivot, a moment of respite for those who, within just a few minutes, had begun to see their prior conceptions of Jefferson evaporate away. I felt disappointed, wanting David to continue exposing the parts of Jefferson's legacy that so frequently remain buried. This was the purpose of the tour, I thought, to excavate unsavory stories and wrestle with them, outwardly, honestly, without pause. But as soon as the thought came, David began the second half of his statement. Those presents were human beings among the enslaved community. David knew what he was doing. The pedagogical equivalent of a crossover in basketball, lulling your opponent in one direction, inducing them into a momentary assurance that they know in which direction things are moving, before promptly switching hands right underneath their outstretched arms, leaving them frozen in place behind you as you drive to the basket. David continued to refer to the enslaved black people living on Monticello as human beings. The decision to use human as the primary descriptor rather than slave was a small yet intentional move. He described the games the children played on warm Sunday afternoons, the only day of the week they did not have to work, the songs enslaved workers sang late into the evenings, the celebrations they took part in when someone was married. What reverberated throughout was the humanity of the enslaved people, their unceasing desire to live a full life, one that would not be defined simply by their forced labor. David, and every other tour guide on the plantation, had to convey this sense of personhood with limited access to stories of the enslaved themselves. Historian Lucia Stanton, who has worked as a historian at Monticello for over three decades, has wrestled with this. To reconstruct the world of Monticello's African Americans is a challenging task. Only six images of men and women who lived there in slavery are known, and their own words are preserved in just four reminiscences and a handful of letters, she wrote. Without the direct testimony of most of the African American residents of Monticello, we must try to hear their voices in the sparse records of Jefferson's farm book and in the often biased accounts and letters dealing with labor management and through the inherited memories of those who left Monticello for lives of freedom. Even with limited resources, David brought these stories to life. He finished his preamble to the tour. You know, if you take it all together, those documents, like Jefferson's farm book, the memories from people who call Monticello home, and then the archaeology, the story does begin to unfold. Despite the horror and oppression of slavery, those families who once lived here, what are they doing? They're trying to carve out some kind of normal life. They're passing on tradition. They're giving their kids a chance to learn and a chance to play. Maybe they're even trying to shield those children from the reality. I looked around the lawn and imagined what Monticello would have looked like two centuries ago. It belonged to Jefferson, yes, but it was not his home alone. It was the home of hundreds of enslaved people, including several large families. Some families were enslaved at Monticello for three generations or more. There were the Gillettes, the Hearns, the Fawcetts, the Grangers, the Hubbards, and the Hemingses. I scanned the landscape and imagined the Gillette children running between horses as the animals were groomed and fed, their adolescent voices swirling in the mountain air. I thought of David and Isabel Hearn, how despite marriage between enslaved people being illegal in Virginia, they were wed and remained so until Isabel's death. I imagine how they might have taken breaks from work under the shade of mulberry trees, whispering and laughing and holding each other in their arms. I thought of Joseph Fawcett, who remained at Monticello while his wife was taken to Washington, D.C. to train as a cook in the White House kitchen during Jefferson's presidency. How three of their children were born in the White House. How in 1806, Jefferson thought Joseph had run away when he had in fact gone to see his wife in Washington. I thought too of how in 1827, after Jefferson's death, Edward and Jane Gillette, along with 9 of their children and 12 of their grandchildren, were sold. How David Hearne, along with his 34 surviving children and grandchildren, were sold. How Joseph Fawcett was freed in Jefferson's will, but his wife, Edith, and 7 of their children were sold. How these families were separated to posthumously pay off Jefferson's debts. I thought of all the love that had been present at this plantation, and I thought too of all the pain. David waved his hand for us to follow him, and we walked from the area adjacent to Jefferson's home down Mulberry Row, where some of the enslaved families had lived. David found a cluster of benches under a grove of mulberry trees and motioned for us all to take a seat. As he positioned himself between us and the garden behind him, he told the story of an enslaved worker named Carey, a teenage boy who was part of the plantation's nail-making operation. The enslaved adolescent boys were directed to make close to 1,000 nails a day, and they could be beaten if they fell too far behind. One day, Carey's friend Brown Colbert hid one of Carey's tools as a joke. Carey knew there was nothing funny about not being able to find his tools. Carey became so angry, an anger likely stemming from a profound sense of fear, that he hit his friend over the head with a hammer, temporarily putting him in a coma. Although Brown Colbert recovered, Jefferson found himself in a difficult position. What was Jefferson to do with someone who had almost killed another member of the Monticello community? Should he be whipped? What did the community of other enslaved people want? What would Brown's family want? What were the implications of letting Carey stay? What were the implications of sending him away? Ultimately, Jefferson gave orders to sell Carey, as David put it, to a place so far away he'll never be heard from again, so that it will appear to the other nail makers as though he had been put away by death. Soon after, slave traders came to Monticello and paid $300 for Carey. No one at Monticello would ever see or hear from him again. While largely the same families remained on the Monticello plantation throughout their lives, Carey's story made me think of the larger practice of family separation during slavery, beyond Monticello. The splitting of families was not peripheral to the practice of slavery. It was central. And soul by soul, historian Walter Johnson writes, of the 250,000 interstate sales made by the traders in the decades before the Civil War, 25% involved the destruction of a first marriage, and 50% destroyed a nuclear family. Many of these separating children under the age of 13 from their parents. Nearly all of them involved the dissolution of a previously existing community, and those are only the interstate sales. Historian Edward Bonekemper estimates that over the course of chattel slavery's existence, about 1 million enslaved people were separated from their families. Scenes and descriptions of family separation are central to the narratives enslaved people wrote and published throughout the 18th and 19th centuries. One of the most harrowing comes from a man named Henry Bibb in his Narrative of the Life and Adventures of Henry Bibb, an American Slave, written by himself, which was published in 1849, 4 years after the publication of Frederick Douglass's book with a similar title. Bibb escaped slavery in Kentucky and fled to Canada, where he became a well-known abolitionist, starting a newspaper called Voice of the Fugitive. In his book, there is an astonishing illustration of a man in a suit standing atop a table in the middle of a room, looking down at the people beneath him. In his left hand is a gavel, his fingers wrapped around its neck, and in his right hand is a black infant, the small child dangling by the wrist. A woman, who looks to be the child's mother, is beneath the man, on her knees, arms outstretched in desperation, pleading for mercy from men who have sought to render themselves gods. There are several other white men in the frame, all wearing suits and brimmed hats. The one to whom the mother seems to be directing her pleas stands to the left of the table, with what looks like a cigarette between his lips. Another, at the edge of the frame, holds a whip above his head, its lash cracking in the air. Along the lower half of the frame are the enslaved. Some of them are in chains, and two of them are holding each other. One has his head buried in his hands. Next to the illustration, Bibb writes in devastating detail. After the men were all sold, they then sold the women and children. They ordered the first woman to lay down her child and mount the auction block. She refused to give up her little one and clung to it as long as she could, while the cruel lash was applied to her back for disobedience. She pleaded for mercy in the name of God, but the child was torn from the arms of its mother amid the most heart-rending shrieks from the mother and child on the one hand and bitter oaths and cruel lashes from the tyrants on the other. Finally, the poor little child was torn from the mother while she was sacrificed to the highest bidder. In this way, the sale was carried on from beginning to end. There was each speculator with his handcuffs to bind his victims after the sale, and while they were doing their writings, the Christian portion of the slaves asked permission to kneel in prayer on the ground before they separated, which was granted. And while bathing each other with tears of sorrow on the verge of their final separation, their eloquent appeals and prayer to the Most High seemed to cause an unpleasant sensation among the ears of their tyrants, who ordered them to rise and make ready their limbs for the scaffolds. And as they happened not to bound at the first sound, they were soon raised from their knees by the sound of the lash and the rattle of the chains, in which they were soon taken off by their respective masters, husbands from wives, and children from parents, never expecting to meet until the judgment of the great day. Though Jefferson was acutely aware of the impact that selling an enslaved person to another plantation could have on the rest of the enslaved population, he still sold more than 100 over the course of his life. Lucius Stanton writes that Jefferson, like other antebellum Virginians who considered themselves enlightened, preferred that his enslaved property be sold in family units. Typically, he only sold individuals when he was hard-pressed financially. In 1820, he wrote that he had scruples about selling Negroes but for delinquency, or on their own request. And it is true that there were occasions in which Jefferson would sell or buy an enslaved person to reunite them with a spouse, quote, where it can be done reasonably. According to Jefferson, he wanted a scenario in which neither husbands and wives, nor children and parents, would be split apart. But Jefferson did allow families to be separated under his watch. He separated children as young as 13 from their parents by sale, bought children as young as 11, and separated children under 10 from their families by transferring them between his own properties or giving them to family members as gifts. Jefferson believed himself to be a benevolent slave owner, but his moral ideals came second to, and were always entangled with, his own economic interests and the interests of his family. Jefferson understood as well the particular economic benefits of keeping husbands and wives together, noting that a child raised every 2 years is of more profit than the crop of the best laboring man. Jefferson believed that he might absolve himself of some of the barbarism of slavery by reducing the extent to which he employed its most brutal tactics. The whippings of his slaves, for example, quote, must not be resorted to but in extremities. He wanted the best of both worlds, looking for overseers who might be less brutal than was typical for late 18th century Virginia, and who could do so without compromising the yield and efficiency of the plantation. When Robert Hemings, the mixed-race enslaved workman who was the child of Elizabeth Hemings and Jefferson's father-in-law, John Wales, found a wife and requested to buy his freedom, Jefferson grew angry because he, quote, expected loyalty for the indulgences he had granted Hemings, and could not understand that a slave might choose freedom and family over fidelity to the master. But absolution, in Jefferson's case, could never be attained by simply refusing to participate in the most heinous aspects of slavery. To own an enslaved person was to perpetuate the barbarism of the institution, and when he felt it necessary to maintain the order that made his life possible, Jefferson engaged in some of the very practices he claimed to so deeply abhor. Around 1810, James Hubbard, an enslaved man who worked in Monticello's nail factory, ran away. He had done so once before, about 5 years prior, and was caught shortly after his escape. This time, he was caught about a year later. When Hubbard was returned, Jefferson wrote, "I had him severely flogged in the presence of his old companions." Although he attempted to create distance between himself and the abuse by assigning the task to an overseer, Jefferson knew, just as slaveholders throughout the South knew, that the spectacle of public assault was a means of both asserting authority over and maintaining order among enslaved workers. Over the course of David's hour-long tour, I found myself watching two women in particular. Each time he presented a new story, fact, or piece of historical evidence about Jefferson as an enslaver, their faces would contort in astonishment, their mouths would sit agape, and they would shake their heads, almost as if they were being told on authority that the earth was flat after all. After David completed his tour, and people dispersed to visit the rest of the plantation, I approached the two women and asked them if they would be open to sharing their reactions to what they had just heard. Donna folded her brochure and used it to fan the back of her neck. Her silver hair took on a yellowish hue under the midsummer sun and was tied in a ponytail that fell past her shoulders. She rocked from side to side as we spoke, shifting her weight from one leg to the other, her black flip-flops squeaking softly under the changing pressure. Her voice was imbued with a gentle Texas lilt that stretched out her eyes and melted her L's into the breeze. Grace's voice, on the other hand, was higher and more hurried. Her short salt-and-pepper hair was only a few inches long and hugged her scalp. Her skin had become sun-blotched from years spent living in Florida, even though, she told me, she was originally from Vermont. Both were warm and welcoming when I approached them, as a cool wind passed and gave us a moment of relief from the summer heat. I asked them if, before coming on this tour, they had been aware of Jefferson's relationship to slavery, how he had flogged his enslaved workers, how he had separated loved ones, how he had kept generations of families in bondage. Their answers were swift and sincere. No. No. They both shook their heads, as if perplexed by what they had just learned. There was a discernible sense of disappointment, perhaps in themselves, perhaps in Jefferson, perhaps in both. You grow up and it's basic American history from fourth grade. "He's a great man. He did all this," Donna said, gesticulating with her hands and almost retroactively mocking the things she had previously been taught about Jefferson. "And granted, he achieved things, but we were just saying, this really took the shine off the guy." "Yes, that's a good word," said Grace, nodding her head. Grace had been married to Donna's brother before he passed away. They were already close, but since his passing, they had found comfort in each other's companionship, traveling together to different places across the country, particularly sites of historical significance. They explained that they had been drawn to Monticello because they were fascinated by the architecture that had been created without the aid of modern-day tools and machinery. Donna, in particular, admired the artisans who had constructed such intimately detailed designs on structures that were still standing today. "I'm kind of a history nut," she said, "and I just wanted to see the house because I love going to towns, because they built things back in a time without all the fancy tools." Jefferson's house, which took more than 40 years to complete, was the embodiment of so much of what they admired. Historian Annette Gordon Reed has written of how before the home could even be built, enslaved workers had to shave off the top of the mountain in the dead of winter, at a time when there was no mechanical technology to assist them beyond the shovel in their hands. Additionally, because there was no available water supply at the peak of the mountain, enslaved workers had to dig 65 feet into the earth, twice as deep as was typically required, over the course of 46 days before they found water. The home itself is an 11,000-square-foot, 43-room manor. Its iconic west front has four Doric-style columns constructed using more than 4,000 curved bricks that were then plastered to resemble stone. The column supports a roof that extends from the front of the house, forming a portico where Jefferson would sit and entertain his guests, statesmen, philosophers, tradesmen, and old friends. Hundreds of thousands of cinnamon-red bricks provide texture to the home's facade, with green shutters hugging white frame windows that glittered in the sunlight. Much of the house's design was inspired by Jefferson's time in Europe and by ancient Roman and Renaissance architecture. He used both free white laborers and his own enslaved workers to move his vision toward reality. "That's why I like to go to these," Donna said, again referring to the impressive aesthetics of the house. "Jefferson was just a sideline. But boy, this. She was looking down, shaking her head. "This man here," Grace interjected, looking in the direction of David, who was chatting with two visitors who had lingered behind after the tour, "just opened a whole new avenue to me." "It just took the shine off," Donna repeated. "He might have done some great things, but boy, did he have a big flaw." What's fascinating about Jefferson is that this is a flaw of which he was wholly cognizant. In Notes on the State of Virginia, he wrote, "There must doubtless be an unhappy influence on the manners of our people produced by the existence of slavery among us. The whole commerce between master and slave is a perpetual exercise of the most boisterous passions, the most unremitting despotism on the one part and degrading submissions on the other. Our children see this and learn to imitate it, for man is an imitative animal. The parent storms, the child looks on, catches the lineaments of wrath, puts on the same airs in the circle of smaller slaves, gives a loose to his worst passions, and thus nursed, educated, and daily exercised in tyranny, cannot but be stamped by it with odious peculiarities. The man must be a prodigy who can retain his manners and morals undepraved by such circumstances." Despite his apparent self-awareness, Jefferson considered his enslaved workers a valuable asset that might help reduce the debts that plagued him. "The torment of mind I endure till the moment shall arrive when I shall not owe a shilling on earth is such really as to render life of little value," he wrote in a letter to a friend in July 1787. "I cannot decide to sell my lands. I have sold too much of them already, and they are the only sure provision for my children. Nor would I willingly sell the slaves as long as there remains any prospect of paying my debts with their labor." Jefferson hoped to put his enslaved workers, quote, "on an easier footing once his finances were stable, but he remained in debt for the rest of his life." Nearly all of his enslaved workers, about 200 people at the time, at Monticello and another property, were auctioned after his death in 1826 to pay off his debts. Jefferson knew that slavery degraded the humanity of those who perpetuated its existence because it necessitated the subjugation of another human being. At the same time, he believed that black people were an inferior class. This is where Jefferson's logic falls apart, historian Winthrop D. Jordan wrote in 1968. If Jefferson truly believed that black people were inferior, then he must have suspected that the Creator might have in fact created men unequal, and he could not say this without giving his assertion exactly the same logical force as his famous statement to the contrary. Jefferson believed that it was impossible for blacks and whites to live peacefully alongside one another after the emancipation of the enslaved, stating in his 1821 autobiography, "The two races, equally free, cannot live in the same government. Nature, habit, opinion has drawn indelible lines of distinction between them." In a letter written to his friend Jared Sparks on February 4, 1824, Jefferson reflected on the possibility of the expatriation of black people through the establishment of a colony on the coast of Africa. But he had already discarded African colonization as unfeasible because of the expense. "I do not say this to induce an inference that the getting rid of them is forever impossible, for that is neither my opinion nor my hope," he wrote to Sparks, "but only that it cannot be done this way. There is, I think, a way in which it can be done," he continued, "that is, by emancipating the afterborn, leaving them, on due compensation with their mothers, until their services are worth their maintenance, and then putting them to industrious occupations until a proper age for deportation." He had come to believe that the Caribbean was a promising destination. "San Domingo is becoming independent, and with a population of that color only, and if the public papers are to be credited, their chief offers to pay their passage, to receive them as free citizens, and to provide them employment." What Jefferson was proposing was that the government purchase newborn slaves from their enslaver, have them stay with their mothers until they were ready to separate, and then send them off to San Domingo modern-day Haiti. He expressed similar views in an 1814 letter to Edward Coles, then James Madison's private secretary, and a man who would go on to become the second governor of Illinois. "I've seen no proposition so expedient," Jefferson wrote, "as that of emancipation of those slaves born after a given day, and of their education and expatriation at a proper age." In 1807, during the second term of his presidency, Jefferson signed an act prohibiting the importation of slaves to the United States. If Jefferson believed slavery would slowly die out after the transatlantic slave trade was abolished, however, it was a hypothesis that ran counter to the evidence available on his own farm. Per his farm book, there were at least 22 births and 12 deaths among his enslaved population between 1774 and 1778. According to the scholar Michael Tadman, among North American slaves, births greatly exceeded deaths, so that the slave population expanded rapidly. Indeed, the North American pattern was probably, with a few local and sometimes short-term exceptions, unique in the history of slavery. As historian C. Van Woodward wrote, "So far as history reveals, no other slave society, whether of antiquity or modern times, has so much as sustained, much less greatly multiplied, its slave population by relying on natural increase." After the invention of the cotton gin in 1793, the cotton industry exploded, and with it, the need for slave labor. According to the National Archives, the yield of raw cotton doubled every decade following 1800. In 1790, there were 8 slave states. In 1860, there were 15. Jefferson saw the beginning of this expansion, but would not live to see how all-encompassing the peculiar institution became. By 1860, about 1 in 3 Southerners was an enslaved person. As much as he said he detested slavery, Jefferson did not spend a large portion of his life attempting to limit it in the United States. His original ordinance of 1784 would have barred slavery in the Northwestern territories after 1800, although it would have allowed enslavement during a 16-year grace period in between. But that proposal was rejected. Afterward, Jefferson largely left the issue of the domestic abolition of slavery untouched, beyond private conversations and correspondence. Jefferson, it seems, was above all a statesman, and upon recognition of how increasingly steadfast opposition to any semblance of abolition was in Virginia and throughout the South, he largely backed away from public admonishment of the system. Privately, he both condemned slavery and expressed ambivalence about freeing enslaved people. "To give liberty," he wrote in a letter in 1789, "or rather, to abandon persons whose habits have been formed in slavery is like abandoning children." Gordon Reed notes that in the latter half of his life, Jefferson resigned himself to the fact that slavery would not be abolished in his lifetime, and certainly not through any endeavor led by him. He believed that the project of emancipation would be carried out by another generation, and that he and his revolutionary colleagues had done their part by emancipating the colonies from Great Britain and creating the world's first constitutional republic, a place where these questions would even be able to be grappled with in the first place. The sun was now hidden behind a thin layer of clouds that temporarily eased the heat on our necks. I asked Donna and Grace what they had previously been taught about all of this. "You know, we studied Jefferson," Grace said. "The slavery part was not part of it." "Well, it wasn't detailed," Donna shared. "It didn't put any heart and thought into it. In high school and college, you didn't think, these are families. These are moms and dads being separated from each other. So that wasn't part of the education." David had spent time in the early part of the tour talking about how children on the plantation made marbles out of clay from the road, playing with one another under the shadow of their shacks as the sun set each evening. He had talked about how the enslaved celebrated weddings, birthdays, and funerals, how they used writing slates they hid from overseers in order to learn how to read and write. Donna and Grace and so many people, specifically white people, often have understood slavery and those held in its grip only in abstract terms. They do not see the faces. They cannot picture the hands. They do not hear the fear or the laughter. They do not consider that these were children like their own, or that these were people who had birthdays and weddings and funerals, who loved and celebrated one another just as they loved and celebrated their loved ones. Donna seemed particularly appalled by how the institution of slavery had affected the children. "I mean, splitting families," she said. "Oh my God, how can you split a family?"
"It's happening now," said Grace. As the three of us held our conversation in July 2018, the Trump administration had already separated roughly 3,000 children from their parents at the southern border of the United States, invoking the outrage of millions in the U.S. and abroad. We had heard about mothers and fathers being told that their children were simply going to be given showers, only to have them learn, after hours had passed, that their children had been taken somewhere else, someplace they did not know. These two women, self-proclaimed Southern Republicans, found themselves identifying the parallels between families separated during slavery and those separated while seeking asylum in the United States from violence in Central America. Donna came from a family in which she said her mother had extreme views. When I asked her what she meant by extreme, Donna described her mother's stance using a phrase that was not uncommon in the discourse of many white Southerners. "The only good one is a dead one." The "one" here is, of course, a genteel metonym. It was a phrase I had heard from my grandparents as they spoke of the way white people had talked to them, growing up in the mid-20th century Jim Crow South, where the law did not protect you from the terror of white supremacy, but instead abetted it. The uncensored version of this phrase goes, "The only good nigger is a dead nigger." Here I was, on a plantation that enslaved hundreds of people who had skin like mine, having a conversation with a white, conservative, Fox News-consuming woman from Texas, whose mother had conveyed to her throughout her life that people like me were, that perhaps I was, better off dead than alive. A woman with whom, surprisingly even to me, I was sharing photos of my 14-month-old son. We spoke for a few more minutes, but soon felt the temperature of the air shift. We looked down and saw small droplets of rain begin to freckle the clay road. At one point, Grace, repeating for herself more than for anyone else, summed up what she, only an hour before, had never been forced to wrestle with. "Here, he uses all these people and then marries a lady and then they have children," she said, letting out a heavy sigh, a reference to Sally Hemings, an enslaved woman who bore at least 6 of Jefferson's children. The two never married. "Jefferson is not the man I thought he was." The truth is that it was not until much later in my life that I too realized that Jefferson was not the man I had been taught he was. It wasn't until 2014, my first year of graduate school, when I read Notes on the State of Virginia, that I was presented with a more complicated, or rather a more accurate, version of Jefferson. I had cautiously flipped toward the sections that specifically considered Jefferson's relationship to slavery and encountered a passage in which he theorized that black people, quote, "are inferior to the whites in the endowments both of body and mind." I had also read the passage where he said of Phyllis Wheatley, widely understood to be the first published black poet in the history of the United States, that, quote, "the compositions published under her name are below the dignity of criticism." Jefferson believed that black people, as a rule, were not capable of poetic expression. "Misery is often the parent of the most affecting touches in poetry," he wrote. "Among the blacks is misery enough, God knows, but no poetry. Love is the peculiar estrum of the poet. Their love is ardent, but it kindles the senses only, not the imagination." At the time I encountered this passage, I was finishing what would be my first collection of poetry. I was writing in the aftermath of the Ferguson uprising, using poetry to process the incessant state-sanctioned violence happening to black people all around me, attempting to put my life in conversation with this political moment and the history that birthed it. I spent hours poring over both the voice and the form of my poems, revising, rearranging, adding, and deleting, until there were dozens of iterations of every stanza, every line. I thought of how seriously I took the craft. I thought of how all my work even in response to violence, stem from a place of love. A love of my community, a love of my family, a love of my partner, a love of those hoping to build a better world than the one we live in. When I read Jefferson's disparagement of Wheatley, it felt like he had been disparaging the entire lineage of black poets who would follow her, myself included. And I saw a man who had not had a clear understanding of what love is. When Robert Hayden gave us ballads to remember how captured Africans survived the Middle Passage and arrived on these shores, it was an act of love. When Gwendolyn Brooks wrote about children on the south side of Chicago playing with one another in neighborhoods left neglected by the city, it was an act of love. When Audre Lorde fractured this language and then built us a new one, giving us a fresh way to make sense of who we are in this world, it was an act of love. When Sonia Sanchez makes lightning of her tongue, moving from southern colloquialisms to stanzas shaped by Swahili, traversing an ocean in one breath, it is an act of love. Jefferson's conceptions of love seem to have been so distorted by his own prejudices that he was unable to recognize the endless examples of love that pervaded plantations across the country. Mothers who huddled over their children and took the lash so that their little ones wouldn't have to. Surrogate mothers, fathers, and grandparents who took in children and raised them as their own when their biological parents were disappeared in the middle of the night. The people who loved and married and committed to one another, despite the omnipresent threat that they might be separated at any moment. What is love, if not this? There is no story of Monticello, there is no story of Thomas Jefferson, without understanding Sally Hemings. We have no letters or documentation written by Sally Hemings, birth name likely Sarah, and nothing written by Jefferson about her. There are no photographs of her. Almost all of what we know of her physical appearance comes from Isaac Jefferson, who was enslaved at Monticello at the same time as Hemings, and described her as mighty near white. Sally was very handsome, long straight hair down her back. Other than that, all portraits that depict her likeness are rendered from the imagination of the artist. She is a shadow without a body, a constellation for whom there are no stars. And yet the story of Sally Hemings sits at the center of Monticello. For two centuries, Jefferson scholars, as well as Jefferson's acknowledged descendants, rejected the idea, despite evidence to the contrary, that Jefferson had either a romantic or a sexual relationship with Sally. They most certainly rejected the idea that he had fathered all six of her children. Sally Hemings' mother, Elizabeth, was a mixed-race enslaved woman owned by Jefferson's father-in-law, John Wales. Elizabeth, often called Betty, likely gave birth to six of Wales' children while in bondage. Sally Hemings was the youngest. This meant that Sally and Jefferson's wife, Martha, were half-sisters. Before Martha passed away at age 33, she made Jefferson promise not to marry again. Jefferson, who deeply loved his wife, abided by that promise. This did not prevent him, however, from beginning a nearly four-decade sexual involvement with Sally, one that started when she was around 16 and Jefferson was in his mid-40s. Jefferson's relationship with Sally, to the extent that an association animated by ownership of one person over another can be classified as such, was seemingly an open secret during Jefferson's lifetime. In 1802, journalist James Callender wrote a series of salacious articles in the Richmond Recorder in which he claimed that Jefferson had fathered several illegitimate children by his slave, quote, concubine. It is well known that the man whom it delighteth the people to honor keeps and for many years past has kept, as his concubine, one of his own slaves, one story began. Her name is Sally. Callender had not always been an antagonist of Jefferson. In fact, after Callender was fired from his job at the Philadelphia Gazette and found himself drowning in debt, Jefferson, aware of the political importance of having strong relationships with newspapers, assisted Callender in finding a new newspaper job and even paid him directly, off and on, for several years. After being imprisoned under the Alien and Sedition Acts for his anti-federalist writing, Callender returned to a world in which Jefferson was president of the United States. Callender, in light of his friend's newfound power, expected some expression of material gratitude for the years of pro-Jefferson writings. Callender wanted to be Richmond postmaster. Jefferson did not appoint him to this position. In fact, he did not appoint Callender to any job. Callender, feeling particularly aggrieved, used his new position at the Richmond Recorder to circulate the Jefferson Hemings story, hoping to sabotage Jefferson's political career. Word spread as the story was reprinted in newspapers across the country. Jefferson never outwardly denied the allegation. He didn't have to. As Gordon Reed writes, most people either did not believe the Jefferson Hemings story or did not consider it significant enough to alter their vote for Jefferson's second term. Further, though it may have been taboo, it was not at all uncommon for white male enslavers to have sex with the black women enslaved on their plantations. Jefferson went on to win re-election. A new exhibit about Sally Hemings was one of the reasons I decided to visit Monticello. The exhibit promised to capture her story in its fullness and complexity. It is a story that Monticello had been figuring out how to tell for a long time. A story that, perhaps, took them too long to tell. A blade of light cut through the open door frame of what may have been Hemings' living quarters, a small plaster-walled room with a red brick floor. Inside, a 5-minute video played, telling the story of Sally Hemings and her involvement with Jefferson. The video was projected onto the wall, and Sally, because we don't know what she looked like, appears as a silhouette, first with a pregnant belly, then alongside silhouettes of her 4 children who survived into adulthood. Beverly, Harriet, Madison, and Espen, 3 sons and 1 daughter. She is seen braiding her daughter's hair while the child's brothers practice violin, the instrument Jefferson played, just a few feet away. The shadows of the children fade away, reappear, and then fade away again, almost as if to resemble their fleeting presence in the discourse around their father. On the projection, their names appear in Jefferson's farm book on a page entitled Role of Negroes, their cursive monikers easily lost amid the other names. He was not in the habit of showing partiality or fatherly affections to us children, said Jefferson's formerly enslaved son, Madison Hemings, to an interviewer in 1873. We were the only children of his by a slave woman. Jefferson's association with Hemings was not an aberration of the time, and it was also reflective of the insidious, tangled relationships between white men and enslaved women. In 18th century Virginia, white male enslavers had full dominion over their enslaved human beings, and full sexual dominion over enslaved women. The relationships were inherently corrupted by the power dynamics embedded within them. These women were in no position to refuse the advances of their owners, or of any other white man who wanted them. There was no legal recourse, and both parties knew this. In fact, one of Jefferson's dear friends, John Hartwell Cock, wrote in his diary that it was not at all uncommon for bachelor and widowed slave owners to have an enslaved woman serve as a substitute for a wife. For Jefferson, after promising Martha that he would not marry again, being involved with an enslaved woman like Sally would have, in its own unsettling way, allowed him to keep his promise. I stepped out of the room after the short film was complete and began reading the signage on the outside walls of the living quarters. To my left was a woman with a badge that indicated she worked for Monticello. She looked in my direction, seeming to anticipate a question, so I asked her what had been on my mind since my conversation with Donna and Grace, whether she thought the people who visited this plantation, and more recently this exhibit, left thinking of Jefferson differently. I knew what Donna and Grace had experienced, but I wanted to know if that was somehow atypical. Teresa, a white woman with reddish blonde hair and soft eyes, stood adjacent to the Sally Hemings exhibit. She explained that she did think the majority of people left the plantation changed. She said that between the slavery tour and the new Sally Hemings exhibit, Monticello was pushing its visitors to see a more complex and holistic version of Jefferson. She did say, however, that some visitors thought that the museum was trying to be too politically correct, and by portraying Jefferson more holistically, trying to change history. We're not changing history, Teresa said, unfazed. We're telling history by telling the full story, more of the story of everyone who lived here, not just certain people who were able to tell their stories. She continued by saying that there were those who derided her and the rest of the staff at the plantation for trying to, quote, tear Jefferson down. But to me, I think they put him up on a pedestal and deny the fact that he was human. He had things about his life that were flaws, and you've got to look at his life. From the moment he got up in the morning till the moment he went to bed at night, he's relying on slave labor for every aspect, she said. Teresa's own journey to understand Jefferson in totality was one that required unlearning so much of what she had been taught. She had lived her entire life one county over from the grandeur of Jefferson's mountaintop plantation. But when I asked her if she knew about Jefferson's relationship to slavery or to Hemings before she started working at Monticello, she responded, "Oh gosh, no." She told me she had known him only as the man who wrote the Declaration of Independence. For Teresa, her years working at Monticello have been a journey of learning and unlearning. Before giving a tour at Monticello, guides go through weeks of training. There are also regular development sessions in which guides converse about what they learned and share the questions guests may have raised on their respective tours. Training gives staff the tools to deal with people like Donna and Grace, who, while shocked, accepted what they had heard, as well as those who might push back a little bit harder on what they perceive to be an unwarranted tarnishing of Jefferson's legacy. The training has also helped Teresa put the history of Jefferson in conversation with what she sees happening in the broader landscape of U.S. politics. Those rallies they've been having in Charlottesville, she sighed, alluding to the white supremacist rallies that had taken place in the summer of 2017. We need to make sure we know our history. I don't know if I want to go so far as to say embrace it, but learn from it. Behind Teresa was Mulberry Row, which served as the hub of the plantation. Workshops and homes had once lined the road, including several slave cabins. Today, there stood a single replica, meant to serve as an example of the homes where people enslaved at Monticello would live. The cabin sat away from the main residence, but within its proximity, like a moon still caught in the orbit of a planet it could not escape. I stepped inside the cabin and stared at the cracked, uneven planks lining the walls. I looked up at the roof and observed the whisper of sunlight squeezing through one small opening. Soft beads of light rested on my shoulder,